Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Today's edition of The Literary Life features the great chef Eric Repair. In this wide-ranging conversation with acclaimed radio host and print journalist Carlos Frias, Chef Repair speaks of his friendship with Tony Bourdain, his early influences in the kitchen, and his profound connection with the Dalai Lama. This was recorded live at Books and Books on the publication of Chef Repair's newest book, Seafood Simple, of which he writes, "I hope that this book is a source of inspiration and education, encouraging you to cook with confidence and approach seafood with joy and even love. The secret to Seafood Simple is to trust the process and yourself."
Chef, thank you so much for making this time, because it's wonderful to always have a reference book like your books. You know, they're so accessible. And can everybody hear me okay? You make them so accessible, but it's another level to make yourself accessible, to kind of hear the stories behind them and hear the stories behind you, because I think that's so much of how people connect to your work. So thank you.
Thank you very much for your kind words.
So I guess the first things first, where did you eat?
I went to Boucheron.
All right. That's a smart man, or Thomas Keller's newest restaurant in the Gables. You know, that was a good move.
It was a good move, and I was starving because I was flying from Madison, Wisconsin.
Ooh. It's too cold in Madison.
And the food in the plane is not what Thomas Keller does at Boucheron. So I was really starving when I went there.
Yeah,
I'm good now.
Oh, Miami's kind of been a little bit of a. You almost called yourself a local. I think we spoke like for a story when I was the food editor at the Herald some years back, and you felt almost like a local because you had a place here for a long time, right?
Yes.
Or continue to?
In 1991, we opened Brasserie Le Cause in Coconut Grove. It was for the ones who remember. We were there from 1991 to 1994, and we left after the hurricane because we ended up with a couple of boats on the roof, and we thought... Not a good idea.
Didn't fit with the decor.
Didn't go.
But Guibert Lacoste was Gilbert, and
his sister were owning the restaurant. She was in the front, and he was the chef and owner. And I was doing the back and forth, flying from New York. And I spent a lot of time here because it was difficult to open a restaurant in the 90s.
You don't say.
And
in Miami, I mean, Miami was still getting its footing as a restaurant city in 1994.
And Miami Beach was starting. Coconut Grove was still happening and so on. But then I didn't learn my lesson. I came back to to reopen the Raleigh Hotel in Miami Beach when André Balazs took over that hotel, and also the Standard. But I didn't put my name on the door because I was like, just stay in the back and do the food, and that's it.
Well, Gilbert was a real inspiration for you in your career, but also in your life, right?
Oh, yes, for sure. He was he became a dear friend, but he was one of my very important mentors. And he taught me how to basically manage a big kitchen and how to be creative and how to be a good chef. And
he was the founding chef at Le
yes,
Bernardin?
Yes, Le Bernardin opened in 1972 in Paris. I was born. I was seven. And then it was such a success. They decided in 1986 to move from Paris to New York and open in New York, and right away got 4 stars from the New York Times, which was unheard at the time. New York Times never gave 4 stars to a restaurant that opened. And
it's never lost it.
The rest is history, but I joined them in 1991.
And now it's interesting because I think people think of it as your signature restaurant. I mean, it is your signature restaurant. I think it's almost identified with you more than it's almost like the history began there for in a lot of people's minds.
Well, after 1991, we are 2023. It's a long time. And then yes, of course, people identify with me because I became the ambassador of Le Bernardin by doing cookbooks, by traveling, by cooking for benefits all over the U.S. and even outside the country, and being in my kitchen every day, lunch and dinner when I'm not traveling, which is a small part of the year when I'm not. I mean, I'm mostly at Le Bernardin, and traveling a little bit. And for the book, of course, I have a little bit of a book tour. It's about 2 weeks traveling through the U.S. and Canada, and then I'll be back for lunch and dinner until. Until I can't anymore, which hopefully is many years from now.
Right. Well, I think you know your the restaurant is such like an achievement, right? Like, I mean, to maintain 4 stars in the New York Times since it opened, it's all like beautifully presented high level seafood cuisine, and yet this book is meant to be a simple approach, right? Is a way to invite people to get creative with seafood and not be scared of it, because I know it can be like the scariest things to cook. And I will say that, like, my fiance and I, front row here, we like it arrived at my, like, I got it at the house, I brought it home from Books and Books, and she just walked by it and it was immediately caught her attention. And two of the dishes that we made out of it were two of the best fish dishes that we've made at home, period. Yeah. Yeah. And she's a great cook, but it was not brain surgery. Like, it was not, we made the salmon poke.
Yes. And it's a good one. I mean, I'm of course biased. I think it's really good.
It requires no heat, which was like, all right, that's a good way to start. And then we made the branzino dish with the citrus oil over the top and the yes. tomatoes. And what's interesting about that is there's a, you had said that if you can't get fresh fish, it's better to get a piece of flash frozen fish to cook with than to use questionable fresh fish.
Absolutely.
And we used frozen brands, you know, it turned out amazing. And so I guess, so there's a long way of saying, talk to me about that idea, about creating dishes that, even using some frozen fish and one word, it's you're applying no heat at all, you're making something that people can access.
Yes. So to begin, speaking about simplicity, the style of Le Bernardin is about simplicity, because when you cook seafood, as you know, seafood is very subtle in flavors. It's very subtle in the way that you have to cook it and take care of it, and the flesh is very delicate. So a lot of people are intimidated by cooking fish and seafood in general. And I wanted to do this book because I hear so many times people saying, oh no, we don't like seafood. Oh no, we don't cook seafood because it's too difficult. And I'm thinking, it's not rocket science. I mean, I know for sure. And what is very important, it's to know a couple of basics. And what is key, it's to when you choose the products. When you go to the store, you have to know when the fish is fresh or when the fish is not fresh. And so we give you some tips in the book, of course. But you can buy in a store fish that is whole, and you can buy fish that is in fillet. And it's a couple of tricks that really give you information about it, and that will be the success of your cooking. Because if you start with mediocre ingredients, even if you are a genius, you can imagine at the end it's mediocre. So when you buy fish in fillet, the fillet should be kind of translucent, the flesh of the fillet, kind of translucent. If you touch it with your finger, do not hesitate to put your fingers on the fish. I do it every day. It's fine. They don't get mad at you. But if you have a fingerprint in it, it's not a good sign.
That's a good tip.
The flesh should rebound. So translucent, the flesh should rebound. And then the ultimate test is to smell it. And fish doesn't smell like fish. Fresh fish smell like high tide, not low tide. Right? I mean, it's what it is. If you buy fish whole, it's other ways to find out if it's fresh or not. You look at the eyes, and if the eyes are very vibrant, it's a good sign. Sometimes you see kind of a white skin on it, not a good sign. So you look at the gills. So the gills are here behind the ears. I mean, fish don't have ears, but but the gills should be very vibrant, red, ruby red. And then same thing, you touch the fillet and the flesh should spring back. And then you smell it, and it should be no smell. So when you go to a store, or a supermarket, or any place where you go buy your fish, if the store is smelly, it's a bad sign. If the person is dirty, it's a bad sign. The fishmonger. But then the fish cannot smell like fish. And that will be key, because at the end, if you cook fish that is not fresh, you know what's going to happen, right? The house is going to stink. The fish is going to break in your pan. Whatever you're going to be able to grab will be so smelly and fishy. If you have children, they're going to be mad at you. They will. Those tips are very important.
And it'll smell in your house like that bad fish for 3 days, and you'll really never want to make it again. So
you have been there, right?
Yeah, I've been there. I've been there.
But then also, seafood is very, I mean, and we all know that, but seafood is not all the same. Tuna is very different than salmon, very different than halibut, grouper, snapper, scallops, lobster, all shrimp, all of those different species like to be cooked a certain way. And you can enhance the qualities of those species by using specific techniques. So therefore, we, in a book, broke down the book into chapters. So we have a chapter for curing, marinating, so basically making ceviches, steaming, broiling, boiling, baking, roasting, even preserving in a jar. And those techniques, if you follow the techniques, it's idiot-proof. It's guaranteed you will have a great recipe of seafood and everybody will be delighted.
Boom. Yeah, idiot-proof is great because it's fantastic.
Thank you. I guess I'm a good salesman, right?
Yeah, that's. I mean, look, everybody already bought the book, man. You can just calm down. Everybody's already got the book.
Let's forget the chapters.
I want to talk about how you became interested specifically in fish, because I mean, we have another copy of your previous book, which you spoke about, which is your 8 books. It's the one that's not a cookbook. It is your personal. It is a memoir, 32 Yolks, and you talk about growing up in the south of France and also in the north of Spain, in the Andorra region.
Andorra, yes.
So you're fluent in Spanish. He's been hearing you, people. He's been hearing everything you've said about him. Talk to me about learning you've dedicated your life to this particular part of cooking. When did it grab your attention? Was it something about growing up then that you first learned
about cooking seafood or about cooking in general?
Let's both, yeah. When do you want to start with?
In general, I had a grandmother that was Italian. Another one was from Provence. And they were cooking soul food from their region.
Oh, you had the deck stack. Come on.
And it was amazing, of course. And I was allowed at 4 or 5 years old, to go with them to the market, be with them in the kitchen, not touch anything because they didn't want me to mess up anything. And I really enjoyed their food and the experience of being in the kitchen and going to the market. And my mother was an amazing cook, very inspired by the celebrity chef at the time that created Nouvelle Cuisine. I'm speaking about Paul Bocuse and Michel Gérard and those French chefs. Yeah,
Bocuse, they still have a competition named after him, the Bocuse d'Or.
Yes, that is an international.
And sorry for butchering that in
you didn't.
My non-French.
And so my mother was doing breakfast, lunch, and dinner for the family, and she was a businesswoman as well. She had a real serious job. We were eating lunch and dinner on a different tablecloth with different china pattern. They were drinking different wines. I was too young. But we had appetizer, main course, cheese, and dessert every day. Not the same from lunch to dinner or from Tuesday to Wednesday. Every day was different. And I thought every kid in the world was eating like me. I was like, this is...
Michelin-starred meals three times a day.
So in between the grandma and my mom, I was spoiled. And then I was a very bad student. I had very bad grades because I was reading cookbooks at night. And when you read cookbooks, you don't have good grades in math. And at 15, I ended up in a principal office with mom. And they told me that was the end of the story for me in school. And I had to find either way a job or send me to a vocational school. And I decided, of course, to go to culinary school. I looked sad in the office, but I was delighted and happy.
But you had, I want to stop there in that moment because the book is, if you haven't read it, I do recommend it. I don't get any cut of the sales. I'm here for free today. But it's very moving because the you that we see today is this calm, fun, sweet, gentle soul.
That's the wine I had with my friends over
there. That's why he's flushed. But the Eric Ripert in this book was very, not troubled, but, you know, really tough surrounding. You lost your father at a really formative age, right? Yeah. And then there was a stepfather in the figure that made it a rough growing up for you.
Very abusive. And yes, when I did 30, first of all, Random House, the publisher, was after me for 4 years to write this memoir. And I decided to do something light and funny and humoristic. And we started the book. And then I wanted to be very precise in the details. So I micromanage everything in the book. Every phrase, every word, every comma was micromanaged. And then at the end, I said, okay, I have to read the book in one shot so I know for the editing. Tomorrow, so I'm going to read the book in a few hours. And I realized I wrote a modern version of Les Misérables. And I was like, oh my God, what did I do? So 32 York is a bit intense.
Well, your late friend Anthony Bourdain said that he didn't know any of those details, that it read like a Dickens novel. I mean, I kid you not. And the thing is, your voice, the first time I spoke to you was after reading this, and your voice here is crystal clear to you today. So it says something.
I didn't want to lie, but I thought was a lot of the stories were funny, but they were not.
they were like dark, like the dark gallows kind of humor.
Something. I don't know.
So I'm curious. So you have this kind of upbringing, and then so how does cooking then really change your life? It ends up changing the trajectory of your life.
For sure. So I graduate culinary school. I'm 17. I have good grades, actually. And I decide I want to work only in a fine dining restaurant. Only in France, in a 3-star Michelin. At the time, it was only 18 3-star Michelin in France, and actually in the world, because Michelin didn't exist outside France. So I wrote a letter to everybody saying, hey, I'm Eric, I'm 17, I want to work in your kitchen. Nobody sent me a letter back. Nobody. And then at the end of the summer, I received a letter from La Tour d'Argent, which was a very, it's still a very traditional restaurant in 1982, they were celebrating 400-year anniversary of the restaurant.
That's insane. 400-year anniversary. Amazing.
And they sent me a letter saying, call us back, we have a job. So I called back and they said, yeah, we have a job. I said, when do I start? They're like, tomorrow. I was living 1,000 miles away from Paris. I packed, took an airline ticket and arrived in Paris at 17 with nowhere to go. And started in the kitchen of La Tour d'Argent, specialized in ducks. But of course, I was in a fish station. and after that, I did all the stations in La Tour d'Argent, but really I was specialized right away in seafood. Then I went to work for a very famous chef in France, Joël Robuchon.
You may have heard of him, the late Joël Robuchon.
French thought he was God. And I think he is probably the best chef of his generation for sure, and maybe of all chefs. And I worked with him, and I did, again, the fish station with him. So twice. And then he sent me after, I spent 3 years with him. I did my military duties in between, and I was a waiter. Didn't want to cook the food. They burned spaghetti in the water. So I was like, I can't do that.
So you worked as a waiter while you were doing military service?
Yes. Well, I started in the kitchen because I said, well, we're going to send you in the kitchen. And on my first day, they do spaghettis for the officers and the general and all. And they have this big kettle, you say? Full of water. They dump the spaghettis and they burn the spaghettis in the water.
Next book, Spaghetti Simple.
So then I went to see the general and I said, look, I don't mind to do my military duties. It's okay with me. But you have to take me out of that kitchen.
This is a war crime.
I'm going to be depressed. And so he laughed and he said, I'm going to send you to the commandos. And I was skinny like that. And I said, the commandos, me? And then he laughed. He said, now, do you want to be my waiter? I said, yeah, sure, I'd love to be your waiter. And I became his
personal waiter,
his personal waiter until the end of the military duties.
Oh, that's a cushy gig. That's a cushy one.
I gained a lot of weight.
You have this, you grew up, you know, in this very tumultuous house after your father dies. You work for one of the most tumultuous chefs, famously Joël Robuchon. Was the whole idea of the French brigade running it like the military. It, you know, he exuded that feeling, like break a plate over your head type of thing, right? Like, not you specifically, but that has, well, things have, like that have happened, you've seen happen.
He was very demanding, let's put it this way. But in the 80s in France, the culture in the kitchen was very tough. It was a lot of verbal abuse, physical abuse. They were punching you in the shoulders. They were slapping you. They were throwing plates at you, kicking you in the butt. And it was a reason for that, supposedly, which is stupid. The reason was, we take young kids, we're going to break them psychologically, and we're going to rebuild them as champions.
Yeah, I've seen this movie. It's called Full Metal Jacket.
Something like that, right? Yeah. And... we lost so much talent during those times. But anyway, in the kitchen where I was, the chefs were violent. Then when I went to Joël Robuchon at Jamin, he was not physical and he was not a screamer, but he will use ways to really put the knife in your heart.
Give me one that still sticks with you.
Well, I love to make sauce, and I always thought I was a great saucier. Very humble of me. And he knew I love to make sauce. So he will come and test and he will be like, seriously? Really? You do that? You will never be a saucier. And you were like, oh!
And like the title 32 Yolks comes from your obsession to perfect the Hollandaise sauce.
Yes. Well, my first day in La Tour d'Argent, I'm 17 years old. I walk in that kitchen. It's 30 cooks. They're much older than me. They look at me like I'm a weirdo. And after 30 seconds, I cut my finger. They asked me to cut an onion. I cut my finger. And I asked for a Band-Aid, and they couldn't believe it. Then they asked me to go get the Churville, and I asked what it was. And they didn't like it. and then they said, well, make an Hollandaise sauce. I said, okay. And I kind of knew it. You need egg yolks. And I said, how many egg yolks? And they said, 32. I was skinny like that. 32 yolks, it's a lot. And you have to make a sabayon with it. You have to make a cloud out of it, right? Like in a pan. So, of course, I made scrambled eggs. and they were really mad at me.
And you ruined 32 eggs.
And I, on top of it, but it took me about 6 months to really master the Hollandaise, to make the best sabayon, the lightest and tastiest Hollandaise possible. And those 32 yolks in that memoir, which we are not selling, by the way.
Although it is available. Oh, yeah. You've already got this one. I'm just saying, it makes a nice companion piece.
Oh, yeah, you have this one. Forget it. But it took me about 6 months, and that was a turning point in my career. Finally, I was a cook. Finally, I was a line cook in a fine restaurant.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, we can stop on it.
Thank you.
So I know that we have chefs in the audience today, and an experience like the ones you had could not only turn you off, but make you abusive yourself. It could make you abusive of yourself. We certainly know that that has happened to chefs. They fall into, like, kitchens traditionally have been places for substance abuse. And you today are a Buddhist.
Yes.
So what happened? How did that come into your life that kept you from going down the other path? Or did you have to go down the other path first?
So in the 90s, I started to be interested by Buddhism. And I started to read books. And the Dalai Lama in 1989 got the Nobel Prize for Peace. And I read the speech of acceptance from His Holiness. And that was, for me, something that was amazing. I couldn't believe what he was saying in that speech.
It stayed with you, that what
it stayed with me.
His Nobel Prize acceptance speech of Dalai Lama.
For sure.
Were there parts of it that just resonated?
Well, Tibet was invaded by China. It was a very brutal invasion in 1959. He had to escape Tibet, and they slaughtered the Tibetan people. And in his speech of acceptance, he's forgiving the Chinese and the people who torture his people, and is forgiving his people for fighting the Chinese as well, and he make a plea for compassion and so on. And I'm like, wow, if you kill my family, I'm not gonna have compassion for you. But that was for me very inspiring. And then I started to read books, and that was the beginning of me becoming a Buddhist. At the same time, almost at the same time, in 1991, I walk into the kitchen of Le Bernardin, and I'm the chef de cuisine because Gilbert Lecoz wants to develop restaurants, including Brasserie Lecoz in Miami and then one in Atlanta. And I'm this young chef. I'm 24. And what do? I emulate my mentors. So I'm super abusive with the staff. I'm screaming. I'm not physical, but I throw plates on the floor. I have my tantrums. And most of the staff wants to leave and starts to leave. And I'm miserable in my life, like really unhappy in my life. And I don't know why. And one night, I'm sitting in my house. Every night I will sit and think about my day. And I'm like, it's not possible. You cannot be that miserable. What's happening? And I had this kind of moment. I was like, well, if you make people miserable around you, you're not going to be happy, because your brain cannot be happy and angry at the same time. Anger actually is not a quality. Anger is a weakness. And I thought anger was actually a quality, because anger makes you so strong. And I was cultivating that. And the morning after, I went back to Le Bernardin and I said, you know what? I was wrong. We're going to change completely the way we work. And then I had to retrain the sous chefs for a couple of years, because they were like, you trained us to be
assholes.
you said it. And now you're telling us to do the opposite. So they had a bit of a hard time to adapt, but we did it. And today, I have to say, Le Bernardin is a place where I believe people are very happy to come. And we have a lot of young people, people with more experience. But the idea is to bloom and not to be stressed and not to be scared. And it makes the life of everybody simple, right? It's like you go to work, it's enough stress with the lunch and the dinner time. We have a crunch, serving a lot of people at the same time. We don't need to be nasty to each other. We don't need to scare people. And a cook who's shaking like this, as you know, is not going to do a better job than a cook who's like precise like that, right? It makes sense. So
how quickly did you start to see, not just it affect the staff, but when did you, like, how did you see it start to manifest in you?
Immediately. Immediately. I was not as relaxed as I am today, because today I have the position of the guy with the white hair, which is the mentor. So it's the easy job is the mentor. At the time, I was really in the middle of the line with the guys, and it was very physical and tough. Today, I am in the kitchen, lunch and dinner, like I mentioned previously, with the team, but I'm more like the conductor, and I'm making sure that the team perform properly and we do a good job with the food and the flavors and the rhythm of the service and so on.
We can clap for that. We can clap for that.
Thank you.
You were, if I'm not mistaken, you have met the Dalai Lama. And we're with him recently-ish?
Yeah, I went to see him in India in October. To say hello to him.
What's up, Dali?
I mean,
Lali Dali. I like to pop.
I mean, it's not that simple, but I went to say hello, and I had an audience with him in October. I was very happy, and we cooked for him a couple of times in New York when he was traveling and teaching in the U.S. And I met him many times, and he's a great teacher. I go to his teachings when he teach, and today, of course, with our cell phones, you can have the teaching almost live. He's in India, and I'm here, and I can have it, and through the books. And I have the luck to have a teacher that is a monk, is Nepali and Tibetan, and he lives in New York. And once a week, we have some teaching together.
I want to ask you this because I know folks have known for years.
If I may.
Yes. You always may.
Good values are not necessarily related to a religion. It's not related to Buddhism. It's not related to Christianism or to being a Jewish or Muslim or Hindu. It doesn't matter. Universal good values are universal. And good is good and bad is bad. And we're all brothers and sisters at the end, right? And that is important to remember. If I may.
Thank you. When you embrace a lifestyle like that and you see others who are still trapped in a kind of a different and still trying to do it the old way, which I see we less of, but there's still some of that. And how do you try to reach out? I didn't want to get too much into this, but you're lost your friend Tony, and he for years he wrote about it, and even late in life he still discussed struggling with substance and those demons, you know. I'm just curious does that open the door for people to try to reach out, and is at some point do you find that there's only so much you can do, kind of thing?
Well, first of all, behaviors in the kitchen in America are much better than in Europe, because in America the lawyers are very, very successful and very wealthy. And if you start to throw plates at your employees, it's going to cost you a lot of money. The kitchens that I know, especially in fine dining, are fairly civilized. So, of course, sometimes we have some bad days and someone may flip a little bit, but nobody's proud of doing that. And when someone misbehaves, what is important is after the service, when it's quiet again, it's to apologize to the person on the front of the team and say, hey, listen, I'm sorry I said, oh, I did, and I apologize, I was wrong. So that's the culture that we have at Le Bernardin, but I think it's starting to spread everywhere. So misbehaving and verbal abuse, it's mostly on reality shows, on certain TV networks. I won't say his name.
Certain TV chefs.
Actually, I'm going to say his name because he should be ashamed of himself. Gordon Ramsay.
I think we're all saying it.
Shame on Gordon. I mean, shame on the production that produced those shows. Violence and abuse. My generation fought abuse. Why do we promote that again? And as of the second part of your question about drugs, basically, or alcohol, or you cannot last in a kitchen or you cannot last in a restaurant if you are drinking or if you are using substance. It's not possible. It's too hard. So you're going to burn in flames. You're not going to last. I mean, not you. But
well, maybe some of them. Some of them. I'm sure we have some line cooks and chefs here that would need to hear that.
When I speak to young, sometimes I go to culinary school and I speak also to a young audience and even our team, I say, you have to be disciplined. Of course, you can party and you're young and they are in their 20s and they want to go out. But you have to show up on time. You cannot drink at work. You cannot do substances at work. You cannot do those kind of things. And outside, you should not do it either. Now, marijuana is legal, but seriously, I mean, how can you be stoned and cook properly? First of all, you're a liability for others. I mean, you don't even know what you are doing. You're not precise. So it's something that, obviously, it's a no-no in our world. And you were mentioning Tony. Tony was struggling when he was young with drugs and alcohol. But when Tony was out of the kitchen in 2000, when he wrote Kitchen Confidential, he was clean and he was not using drugs, neither drinking too much and so on. He was, of course, enjoying a bottle of wine like I do, but Tony was clean. And he was a big advocate also of promoting that kind of attitude and culture.
Even losing him, you know, it's hard to look back on them, but how did he change your life? Because I read Jose Andres saying that even in losing him, that was something about that brought you guys together. Jose Andres, another, you know, a Spanish guy, background is similar.
Your friend.
How did he influence your life, even and maybe even still influences today? And
I don't think we influence each other's life. I think we were very different, but we had a very solid friendship. And we accept our differences. And when I was speaking about the Dalai Lama, he would be like, and when he was listening to the Ramones or whatever kind of music he was listening, I was like, what is that awful noise? So we didn't really influence each other, but we had a good time together. Off camera and spending vacations, and of course on camera, and people could see that when we were on TV together.
Well, I could keep you here for another hour or two, but I know I'm keeping you all to myself, but I want to open it up. But first to say thank you, Chef.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
We have some questions. This gentleman up here was quickly rose. I'm just going to give him my microphone.
Hello. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Have you seen The Bear? And
yeah.
And the reason I ask is because it seems like that was an attempt to show a change from the old culture to the more forgiving or a collegial culture that you've talked about.
I have seen The Bear. I saw the menu too.
Ooh, yes.
So I cannot relate to the stupidity of the menu. I mean, The Menu is a great movie, it's a satire, and it's making fun of certain aspects of my industry. And I cannot relate to those stupid things. But I like the movie.
You don't want to set fire to the whole restaurant and everybody in it? Did I spoil the movie? Sorry.
Yeah, that's a spoiler. But I think in The Bear, the acting is fantastic. Fantastic. I have a hard time to connect with the story. To me, it's a little bit surreal, but maybe it happens in restaurants. I don't know. I am on season two. And I love Jeremy, the actor. The main, he's fantastic, but it's hard for me to watch it. I think it reminds me of The Office a little bit.
How do you support your staff and have this kind of tireless energy to keep going to events, whether they're in the Cayman or Cayman Islands or wherever it is, to support your chefs and your chef friends?
Well, when you are in a position of leadership, it's a privilege, but it's also an obligation to give back. And people work hard. So you mentioned the Cayman Cookout. People work hard in that event. But in our restaurant, the employees work really hard. And they need someone who's going to give them guidance. They need someone who's going to help them to grow and bloom. And for me, it's part of my life. I wake up in the morning and I'm thinking about my day and I'm there for that. So I have no stress whatsoever. I have a good organization, a lot of people around me, making sure that I show up at the right place at the right moment. But it's you know, when you are in my position, you have to create a team. And you create a team with talented people that are loyal. And they are loyal because you inspire them. If you don't inspire those people, they're going somewhere else. And this is the obligation that chefs and people in position of leadership have toward their staff and team that support them.
You had a question, sir.
What is the most difficult fish to cook? It's not really in seafood simple.
$34.99 at your local bookstore, like Books and Books.
I know you bought the book, but I basically make the case that every fish is fairly simple to cook. You have to apply the right technique for the right fish. Like tuna is very different than halibut, which is very different than lobster, right? So tuna, maybe you will, if you grill it or you broil, you, not broil it, but grill it or sear it, you may have, or serve it raw, it could be enhancing the qualities of the fish and make it the star of the plate. It may be not the case for cod fish. Cod fish may not be like to be cut raw. And maybe cod fish or halibut, which is very, very delicate, may not like to be seared. You may want to steam it and be more gentle in the cooking. So it's about understanding the every species and about applying the technique that goes to elevate that species. And in a book, it's why we have those chapters with, in every chapter, a different family of seafood.
Give us your thoughts on sustainability and the kinds of fish and procedures that we should be aware of now to keep it sustainable.
So sustainability, as we know, is key. And sustainability everywhere, on Earth, and of course in the ocean. And I am optimistic, but we have to be very cautious. Wild fish taste much better than a farm-raised fish. Today, farm-raised fish doesn't equal the delicacy of a wild fish. It's many reasons. Wild fish in ocean can be plentiful if the stocks are well managed. But if we are not cautious and we overfish and we over develop the coastline, and we pollute the water, and so on, we are going to lose a lot of species. So what's happening, actually, in America, we're very lucky because the government is very proactive and very tough. And we have some success story, and I'll give you one. The striped bass on the East Coast, northern part of the East Coast, in the 90s was almost extinct. And the government came on and said, we're going to stop for a couple of years to catch striped bass. And the fishermen were very, very upset because it's hard to say to a fisherman who has a boat and is specialized in catching striped bass, you're not going to go fishing. But the government was tough. And today, the striped bass is plentiful. Then, in the late 90s, almost in to 2000, the swordfish were becoming smaller and smaller and smaller until we realized the stock was under stress and we had some very strict rules to protect the species. Today, swordfish is, again, large and plentiful. And we had problems with the Chilean sea bass, which the real name is Patagonian toothfish. Nobody wants to eat Patagonian toothfish. But Chilean sea bass was a genius marketing name that destroyed the species almost. But again, we made a lot of effort to be careful, and now the population is coming back. Today we have the salmon in Alaska and on the West Coast. The wild salmon is under stress, especially the king salmon. So we have to give a break. We have to be also be very proactive in protecting the way the water is used over there with the pollution and so on. Farm raised sometimes, although it's not as good as wild, some farmers have good practices and they do not pollute the land and they do not pollute the water and so on. But very often those farmers, they feed the fish some poor quality food. They give them antibiotics. It's millions of fish in a room like that. And therefore, it means you have to do a little bit of research. And what guides us today in the U.S., it's many organizations, but the Monterey Bay Aquarium publish every year a list of the species that are disappearing and the species that are recovering. And then you have NOAA. And NOAA is a governmental agency that has also a list that is very accurate. And you can follow those lists. You Google it and you know what to consume. For the farms, it's a bit more nebulous. For the salmon, I will say, since Atlantic salmon doesn't exist anymore for a long time, it has disappeared and never really recovered, I recommend if you can buy salmon from the Faroe Islands. Faroe Islands are located in between Iceland and Scotland, and they have amazing practices, and the fish is almost at the level of being wild. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, Eric Ripert.